Welcome to the Voice of the People with your host, November Hansen.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to tonight's live global broadcast of Voice of the People Radio. For all the listeners on the various internet venues around the world, to all the ones on 105.7 FM in New Orleans, and those using their cell phones with UpSnap, I am pleased you could join us. A future guest list is on my website at voiceofthepeopleradio.com. Yes, if any of us appear too loud, just somebody let us know, because I am actually using a microphone as opposed to a telephone, so just let me know. Anyways, I'm still working on the Now project. It's going really good. I have about, I think I'm up to 70 responses now. It's an informal personality survey to see what kind of data might come to light about those who have had experiences with encounters or sightings, or even those just interested in the subject. So far, there are several trends showing up. I have started writing the report. I hope to have the results published by the end of spring. Anyone still wanting to participate, just go to www.icar1.com and fill out the survey found in the left-hand column. This evening, I'm really excited about my program. I'm doing a panel interview. My guests are Nigel Kerner. He is the author of Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, The Conspiracy to Genetically Tamper with Humanity. I have Dr. Andrew Silverman with us and Professor John Biggerstaff. To make this simple and make sure everybody knows who everyone is, I'm going to have the guests introduce themselves. So let's just start with Nigel. Welcome to the program. And if you could tell my listening audience a little bit about yourself.
Well, hi there, November. I'm Nigel Kerner. I'm an author writing out of England. And I come in threes, I'm afraid, with two longstanding colleagues of mine, Dr. Andrew Silverman, who's a medical doctor, as you say, and Dr. John Biggerstaff, who actually is in America at the moment in the University of Tennessee, and he's a cell biologist. And through the years, we've been looking at this UFO phenomenon, and I came at it as a kind of skeptic originally, trying to answer a question my son asked me, you know, are UFOs real? Had no idea what they were, and in fact wanted to kind of peremptorily dismiss him. But I thought I'd better check it out, because these kids, you know, have a way of getting back at you kind of thing. And I did decide to look at this a bit more in detail. Well, it took me, in the end, about 30-odd years to give him an answer. But let me tell you, it had my entire existential scale of belief upside down after I finished. And I think we've discovered, and we want to talk to the world about it in a way, that this UFO phenomenon, in common with so many other people now who are familiar with this on the internet and so on, this is probably the greatest happening, if you like, or phenomenon that has ever confronted intelligent life on this planet, I say. Not very intelligent, because they don't even acknowledge it in the mainstream, but let me tell you, something very strange is going on there. And when you connect up the dots, you get people like Andrew, who's interested in a very important artifact that connects up to this phenomenon of UFOs, believe it or not, called the Shroud of Turin. And we've got John Biggerstaff, who comes and measures up the interface between all these connections and makes sense of some things for us and so on as we go along. So I don't want to get too long-winded, but if I do, please, it's because the subject has so much to say about it, and I don't really mean to kind of go on at length about it, but we'll try and pace it out, if you like, November.
But okay, anyway,
it's very nice to talk to all your listeners and so on.
Oh, no, I'm very excited, and I can tell you right now, there's no way we're going to pack all this information in 2 hours, but we will do what we can. Dr. Andrew Silverman, if you welcome to the program. If you could please introduce yourself to the listening audience, that would be grand.
Thank you. Very pleased to be here. Yes, well, I'm a medical doctor. I first actually got to hear about the Turin Shroud when I saw a life-size photographic print of it in Nigel's house, actually, around about nearly 30 years ago. And I've been fascinated by it ever since. And I recently gave a talk in Italy at a conference about the Shroud, which was largely inspired by some ideas that Nigel put to me many years ago about the Shroud. And it's a fascinating subject, and I look forward to talking about it later.
Oh yes, this is going to be really interesting how all these different components are actually attached to ufology. Professor John Biggerstaff, welcome to the program. If you could introduce yourself to the listening audience, I would be grateful.
Good evening, November, and everyone. Well, again, as Nigel said, we've known each other for very many years, and we've had many interesting arguments, conversations, as he was constructing his ideas for these series of books that he's writing. And during all of that, I've been conversing with him, being a cell biologist and a sort of mainstream scientist. I too was highly skeptical of all of this sort of idea because it's just generally not accepted in science. However, in actually addressing it and actually going and doing some work on it, I had a look around the information, and in fact there are some really interesting things to do with biology, which actually may explain some of what's been observed and what other people are claiming the agenda of these greys or aliens actually is in terms of genetically modifying us. And so I've continued to try and study that and find more ideas and develop some hypotheses by which this could work. And also to do with, Andrew's going to talk to you about the Shroud, but in terms of he's going to talk about, sort of the hard radiation or radiation of some form actually generated this image. Well, I'm very interested, of course, in the mechanism by which a body can actually do that. And so at various points during this conversation, I may come in and add some things to what Nigel and Andrew are saying.
All right. My gosh, there are so many different places to go and where to start. Let me tell you just a little bit about my experience reading all these names up here, Nigel's book. I can keep it brief. First of all, his book is very sophisticated. The language, the terminology, the pictures, making the connections. It's not just some simply quickly put together book. It's very well thought out, very well researched. He incorporates things with UFOs and extraterrestrials such as ghosts, the Shroud of Turin, and biology, which is really fascinating to me myself because that is the aspects that I have studied the subject too, from the biological standpoint looking at that. Now, I'm not a professor of biology or a doctor in anything, but I will say I do know I'm actually pretty intelligent and I can figure a lot of things out. But Nigel, I'm still this connection between you three is still absolutely fascinating to me. I'm really excited that there are professionals in mainstream biology and medicine that are willing to look at this subject from that point of view. How did you guys all make this connection?
Well, very good question, actually, November, if I may say so. On the face of it, if someone came and told me there were three admixtures like us, I wouldn't have believed them. But it just kind of fell out, if you like, in that way, because in this world of ours, we really now are so soaked in everydayness. Our everydayness is kind of so soaked in science, shall we say, that most people need a little bit more affirmation or confirmation about things than it used to be. The way of the world, so to speak, we kind of believed things much more and took them for granted and so forth. But this world of ours now needs definitions a little bit more sharply kind of construed, I think. And I think that's really what underlay the way I approach this elucidation of this UFO phenomenon. And since I was a skeptic, of course, I had to look at it in far more detail because I was out to disprove it. And unfortunately, the more I opened Pandora's box, the more I discovered that this is something that is so incredible and so relevant to our everyday lives. And that's the important thing, is how do you connect up this business, as you say, of soul. And something that was one of the most surprising elements of all of it was, how do you kind of see a thing moving in the sky 25,000 miles an hour, whatever, turns at right angles, have some of the most important people in America and around the world now affirming that this is a real phenomenon. It is not something that we are, as we are encouraged, you know, to believe and so on. It really is out there. And Ed Mitchell and Gordon explain them in our kind of neck of the woods and so forth and so on. And as we go along, you know, children are demanding answers from parents and so forth. And if there's anything in this world that's worthwhile, I think it's the search for truth. What might be true? How, never mind how obscure we might like to make this connection between, you know, something that's a phenomenon that shows up in space-time with our measuring instruments and so forth, and how we do that with something ephemeral, like what most people expect a soul to be, something spiritual, whatever, and then connect that up with a piece of cloth that was found in Liray in France in more recent terms, and how this particular thing, none of us are religious in any sense of the word, of devotion, if you like. However, we do have now, looking at all these over the years, a very powerful sense of those great teachers that started all this religious philosophy business. And we can say that, I think, even though we're soaked in science, all three of us have a great deal of respect now for some of the things they said 2,000 years ago as they said it, and not as people have contrived it, shall we say, more recently, if you see what I'm trying to say. So I'm sorry to give you this long, lengthy tirade, November, but, you know, to get at our train of thought kind of thing, you know, working for us is actually the important thing. So we'll, if you will pardon us, go on like this at length sometimes. Please forgive us for that.
No, Nigel, that's okay. Like I said, there's a lot of information to pack into a two-hour program, and I know it's not happening. I'm hoping some of my constituents are listening to the program, and we'll bring you guys on and carry on from wherever we left off so we can get more of it. Andrew, if it's okay if I call you that.
Yes.
Okay, so the Shrouded Turin. Now, as I was going through Nigel's book, probably one of the things that did surprise me was the appearance of the Shroud of Turin in his book and relating that to extraterrestrials. How would you, I don't know, come up with that idea? I mean, what's the relationship?
Well, I mean, for me, the what the Shroud of Turin is saying about is about the limitless capacity of all human beings. Because basically, I mean, if you look at the image on the shroud, there's no way that we can form an image, anything like that, even with using 21st century technology. So the idea that it was made by an artist just doesn't hold water. And research looking at how the image got on there implies that it was actually a bright burst of light that came from the body of the man that the shroud wrapped, which we'll be going into more detail about later. I think Nigel's thesis is that it is this unique property about humans as compared to the rest of the dead universe, so to speak, which is what these creatures or objects are interested in, and why, you know, that if they were if they were here to try and like some people say they're here to get gold or something like that, why do they actually spend so much time studying human beings, when our technology is so minuscule and tiny compared to theirs, and it does suggest that it's to do with something that we have that they don't. And I'm sure Nigel's going to be talking more in depth about that later on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, can I just come in there?
You know what? I like a natural conversation, so we can just jump all over each other. That's perfectly fine with me.
Okay. Please, November. What I was trying to say is that, you know, you asked a very relevant question, how mainstream science can actually accept these things. Well, in fact, this is more mainstream than mainstream, but the problem is it is so strange, and the ideas through the centuries have been so obfuscated, you know, people have actually tried to see things more simply than they really are. And of course, it's really radical. The view that we've got to take now is so radical because most of us in the past believe things from notation, from someone saying something or whatever. And these days, of course, as I said, people are far more circumspect about these things, and they really, really require the thing actually demonstrated and so forth in a much more detailed sense. And what John would try to do, I think, is to say how mainstream scientists have come to look at the shroud, the ones that have a little bit more intelligence, shall we say, than the wind in the willows type or whatever, the ones with toad hall with the pebble glasses focused in one single set of parallel lines in front of them. The more visionary scientists, you know, would be able to look at this in a much more acceptable light. And John is one of those types of people who through the years have come at this, and maybe his metamorphosis might be of help to your listeners.
Okay.
Hi, John.
John, I wanted to look at the biology for a moment. In Nigel's book, he's looking at melanin, at skin pigment, and also DNA. I would be looking at the endocrinology system and the RNA. So I found it interesting that that's what Nigel was looking at. Can you explain to us what there might be that's unexplainable in human biology that would suggest an extraterrestrial interference?
Well, actually, there's quite a lot in current biology, which is the sort of, I mean, they call it axiomatic as opposed to, you know, actually sort of proved hypothesis. But really, just to set a bit of background here, I mean, prior to all of that, Nigel has really defined really the difference between something which is natural, of which we are an example and animals are an example, and something which is actually artificial. And I saw that one of your guests was actually talking about the concept of quantum physics as it relates to the paranormal. I didn't actually get a chance to listen to it, but I'm sure they will have talked about, you know, this concept of the fact that something needs to be really observed to actually be real in the first place, which is really what one of the originators of quantum physics, Schrodinger, was actually talking about. Now, what this really implies is Schrodinger and people that came subsequently to him really posited that if something can be observed to be real, then there must be an observer. So consciousness is, in fact, an implicit function of the universe. And really, if you then look into cosmology, and I see that you've been talking to cosmologists as well, really, if we take the concept of the Big Bang Theory as it is at the moment, then what that implies is that for something to be real has to be observed. Therefore, it implies that consciousness actually preceded the origin of the universe and therefore came in with it. And therefore, we are therefore, what happened over millennia and millions of years is that you've got a gradual degradation of both processes together. Such that we still have we still have access to this continuum of our origin. Now the thing is, if we just take atoms around us, which no longer have that origin, and we put them together to generate things like artificial intelligence, etc., then we effectively make something that Nigel alludes to as being what these greys are all about. And so what happens here is that because we have this other part to us, which is in fact inaccessible by any force paradigm, because it's like in the space between atoms, a bit like water in between marbles in a jar. It's a continuum. And they have no access to any of this. And so really, I think what their intent is to, as they find that they're decaying over time, etc., then they're trying to leap in and adjust us to actually take advantage of the fact that we can live and die and live again. And effectively, we're effectively eternal from that standpoint. And so a long time ago, I think what's been happening is that these greys, if you like, have come here and they've noticed this going on with living things. And really, they want to sort of piggyback on top of that. And there's quite a bit of evidence, really, from a couple of 100,000 years ago, you know, when we had things like the African Eve, etc. It comes from a very, very small population of hominids that were effectively to make this sudden jump in brain size and pelvis size, etc. And there was a tremendous, effectively generating what we know as a Cro-Magnon man, which then theoretically or has been observed to, or is postulated rather to actually make us in the end. And so what they actually did in that case, I think what's happening there is they're trying to make our DNA, if you like, more like the sort of circuitry they're made of with sort of mercury and sulfur and gold, etc. And in fact, there's a tendency for us now to move into technologies to actually try and put such things into ourselves to actually continue ourselves. And so I think over time we're becoming more and more and more like them. And in fact, we have examples of in our cells, for instance, little powerhouses of the cells, the mitochondria, for instance, may have actually been, in fact, put in there by them to actually give us this sort of boost in energy, if you like, also as a vector for them to get DNA, because we can use them like this, to get DNA back into the cell. And there are various different structures within DNA, which we could go into, which are actually anomalous and really we don't know where they come from, and they seem to work on their own. And they will multiply on their own, and effectively these little sequences have something to do with our lifespans, with cancer, with disease states, susceptibility to disease, and possibly even the way, you know, the way we think, or the tendencies for the way we think. And I think Nigel wants to come in.
Okay, go ahead, Nigel.
Yeah, the interesting thing you see in November is what on earth are these things after? And as John said, I think it's this interface between what is biologically natural and what is synthetically artificial that actually has the key. And I think that these things are synthetic in their nature. They are very much like the kinds of things that are now slowly coming into the paradigm of humanity, where we are asked, you know, to put artificial mechanisms within our body and so on. We seem to be steadily moving towards the kind of transformation of our natural humanity into an artificial version. And so we have to really look at this interface between what is natural and what is artificial. Our progression towards, if you like, what I call SIM card man, it seems to be accelerating. You know, we have chips implanted in our bodies. Millions of people are spending most of their day in virtual reality worlds with games and so on. In Japan, for instance, robots have been made almost exactly to resemble human beings, soft tissue. In fact, that from a relative distance, you would not tell them apart from a human being and so on. So could the grey alien phenomenon, these things which are quite clearly robots, all the great powers have got examples of them, they are hiding them for some reason that is a mystery, and that's a program in itself, if you like. Why are these people hiding these things, and what is the reason for it? You know, if these were wonderful, beneficent things, shall we say, come to our earth with a benediction for humankind, why are they all the time obscured by the media, whatever? what is it that they have that they don't want us to know? People become suspicious about such things and so on. Of course, you can say, you know, maybe it's not our time. Well, human scope is larger than the entire universe. In our dreams, in our schemes, in the wondrous forms of expression we have, poetry, music, all of that, we can take in almost anything. We are eternal in our scope. We know that. We go, we die, we come back in birth again. And some people, in fact, most religions, once upon a time believed in reincarnation. I'm supposed to be a Christian. Someone splashed water on me when I was a baby and called me a Roman Catholic. I have to say that I haven't ever followed any kinds of specific drives of that kind of nature. But in fact, we, the Catholic faith, so to speak, as defined as Roman, once upon a time believed in reincarnation. Jesus himself actually said it many times in so many words in the New Testament and so forth, you know, acknowledged that it exists and so on. But, you know, the Holy Roman Emperor or his wife was responsible for taking out that ethic or that ethos from the Christian codex, if you like. The Muslims once, or Islam once believed in it, certainly Buddhism currently does, and so on. And so there may well be a scope for the continuity of this human expression or resolve, if you like, from the future into the present and then back into the future and so on. And so, you know, it is something that's wondrous. Now, a machine with artificial intelligence has no sense of itself by definition. And so if you create something to actually do utilitarian work in those terms and give it artificial intelligence and give it a directive, you know, look after yourself under all threats or whatever, please make sure that you are there to serve the utilities we're making you for, and you send that with artificial intelligence out into space, you've got a huge paradox and a paradigm arriving there which can actually nicely explain why these things are here in our planet, and looking at even the most primitive hominid, in fact, even an insect, is superior to the most sophisticatedly intelligent gray bioid, or whatever you might call them, because all those things have a origin, a line, a genetic line, if you like, going back to the origin of the universe in a single span, if you see what I'm trying to say. We, in human terms, it can be explained. We have mom, dad, great-granddad, and so on. Go all the way back right to the beginning of the universe. And that's really simply what I call a soul, November. I call that particular line going back of information that defines each one of us individually. I call that line a soul. Nothing mysterious, nothing, you know, out there with new world ethoses and so forth. It's simply that line of information. And if these things, with their sophisticated technology, sophisticated enough to get past the speed of light conundrum of Einstein and get to our planet, if these things, in some kind of way, from another kind of paradigm of existence, perhaps, if you like, come here and they see that this facility is retained by something like us as machines who decay according to the second law of thermodynamics, and I'm sure you know that that means everything rots. Everything goes one way with time. In fact, cosmologists now say the universe is finite and it's going to end one day. Well, if there is a mechanism beyond atoms, maybe, beyond force, in other words, that can actually maintain our existence endlessly, this lot, with their technology, would want to know about that. And I think this is what the whole thing, in a nutshell, is all about. They want to kind of get in on this reserve and carry on their own aegis, their own programs, beat entropy, if you like, through piggybacking on our natural paradigm to live, die, and come back and live again. And I think that's the only thing that we have, relatively primitive though we are against them, that we have that they do not have, and that makes us immensely more valuable to them than you might on the face of it think when you see their ships trudging along as, say, 50,000 miles an hour up there in our space, so to speak. So that's really the big thing here, is how is this all connected up? And when I looked at the UFO phenomenon and I started to see these things, you know, as I affirmed them, and I hope I'm science-soaked myself, by the way, and so I really I wanted to actually make sure that scientists looking at this may have something plausible with their reason to be able to look at and say, hang on, this guy may have a point here, so to speak. That's all. Just take a look at it. Don't run away from it. Don't hide away from it, because it's not the normal thing you look at when you're pursuing your grants or whatever. Just take a look at it and consider it, if you like, you know, and that's really what the ethos is all about, you see.
Well, you know what, Nigel, I've also considered the subject myself as a gateway to education. It's absolutely fascinating gateway to education, because you do learn about other things. You've, you know, researched the Shroud of Turin. You've looked at biology, of course, a whole host, a wealth of other things. It's not just saying, I've seen a UFO, my gosh, they must be real. It doesn't work like that. People are curious in nature, and they have questions, and they go looking, and, you know,
yeah,
it's very
absolutely.
Another thing I wanted to ask about this is, you were talking about biology and the second law of thermodynamics. Now, we also have electricity in us too. So there's an energy. So how do we explain that? That energy never dies, it simply transforms itself.
Yes. Well, word energy is probably the most misused and prostituted word, if I may put it that way, in the English language. It really is. It's used.
You have everybody running for their dictionaries, Nigel. I love it. This is great.
I have to say that it's a word that's used very loosely and so on, and it really has to be used in a very specific context. In fact, this question, I think, would be better answered by Dr. Andrew Silverman or Dr. John Bickerstaff. Andrew has a good take on this particular thing, and maybe we can get Andrew in on this here.
Yeah, well, I kind of got earlier that maybe Andrew had something about the electromagnetic function of the human system when he was talking about the Shroud of Turin, but he'll correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, actually, this is John's quite strong area of expertise. I think I have a lot to learn from him about this, and I think John would probably be better placed to speak about the role of electromagnetism in biology than I would. John?
Yes, I'm here. I'll be happy to talk about it. I actually have got a project running at the moment with some of my students to actually investigate electric fields in cellular function. But again, you know, let's get to sort of what these electric fields do. The body is in fact made up of about, sort of most of it is in fact water, and water with some salt in it actually will conduct electricity very nicely. And we know, for instance, that we know that the body interacts with electric fields from the outside, but what not a lot of research has been done, except in Russia very early on, but there's an increasing amount now of the study of the physics in biology, and this is what I've become really interested in. Now, for instance, if we take, we know, for instance, that collagen in our bones, for instance, is what's called piezoelectric. It's a bit like piezoelectricity is really, you know, those quartz lighters that you have. When you hit a crystal, it will produce electricity. And so piezoelectricity really is that when you deform something, it will generate electricity. Or if you apply electricity to it, it will actually change its shape. And this is incredibly important because collagen, of course, is in bone, it's also in your skin, and it's really the matrix on which your whole of your biology works. And one good example of this actually comes from the application of this in medicine, actually comes from quite a few years ago now. They discovered that when people, for instance, had bones that wouldn't grow back together, they would actually, because they realized that there was an electrical component to this. There was an electric charge across that bone. And if that charge wasn't high enough, what they do is put a little battery across it. In fact, that increased and healed up all of these bones that wouldn't normally heal. But taking advantage of that piezoelectric, rather than poking wires into people's bones, what they then did was to actually use a pulsing magnetic field to vibrate those electrical potentials and therefore that actually made the bone grow better. But the, you know, there was some controversy over using magnetic fields and what they do. And this is rather a huge subject now. But nowadays, what they do is they take advantage of this sort of vibrational mode of the silicon and stuff in the bone. And they actually use ultrasound now as a current treatment for this. So this is an example of the usage of electrical potentials. Now, what I've been working on, if you actually look at the cell itself, it's got a voltage across it of about 60 millivolts, an average cell. Nerve cells will vary up to about 120 or so. Now, 60 millivolts, you go, okay, well, that's not really very much electricity. But in fact, when you consider that voltage is being expressed across 200 nanometers, which is a very, very small, it's tinier than, about a hundredth of a human hair. In fact, when you calculate that as a voltage, it actually comes to sort of millions of volts per meter, which is actually a very huge voltage. But it's all being carried on very large particles, which actually distribute that. And so if you then look at the inside of the cell, there are structures inside of the cell which actually carry electricity themselves. These things are called microtubules, and they all center on on another organelle within the cell called the centriole. And it's from here that people like Stuart Hameroff in Arizona State University, he's an anesthetist or an anesthesiologist, you call it, and he is postulating with Roger Penrose, really, that there are quantum effects occurring within these microtubules, which are actually allowing quantum collapse, if you like, which then generates these electric fields within the cell. And thus we've really got the basic ladder, if you like, from which we can get from these quantum events through into structured electrical potentials within cells. And those electrical potentials, DNA, of course, is a coil, and if you pass a current along a coil, you'll get a magnetic field. And in fact, DNA is piezoelectric in itself, and therefore it's susceptible to shape change if you change the electric field. And shape change is one of the fundamental things that causes DNA to actually express genes. And so you can actually postulate the whole of biology really from the standpoint of physics. And the whole thing is really done through the conduit of biological water, in a way, because water actually will order itself based on the structure of the electric field it's exposed to. And therefore, we've got a mechanism all the way down through the DNA, then in the genetic expression, then into the proteins, and all really shining this light, if you like, which is coming really from the other side of the atoms, which is what Nigel calls our soul, if you like. It's actually having an influence on the order and the structure of all of that. I could go on a very long time about magnetic fields, but that should be a summary.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry, November, but can I just interrupt?
You're fine. Keep going.
very briefly here. It's just simply that whilst you have the schematic that relates in, if you like, John's hardwired ethos about this wonderful, you know, the connection between livingness, energy, and so forth, and how that changes shape, modulation, you know, appearance, and all that kind of thing, there is another kind of shape which it leads to, and that's the fascinating thing that I really began to see in this, which kind of brought energy and the second law of thermodynamics and all of that, and the physical expression of being, material being, and so on, into focus. And that was how this incredible, these great teachers in the past, these religious teachers, always wanted our behavior changed into a modus where things are united rather than separated and divided. You might just say that could be an expression of the word love, if you like. Caring, compassion, what we might call goody-goody in inverted commas, so to speak. And it was really strange that they all claimed that this was the way forward for any kind of meaning at all. And their entire life and life living system and ethos was was based upon that paradigm of good against evil, where they defined good to be all things that were brought together and united as one, and evil as something that you separate, put away, tear up, and destroy, and so forth, which is exactly what the second law of thermodynamics does naturally. So to me, if you like, there is no Satan and devil. There is that law which actually takes and fits that particular paradigm beautifully, the second law of thermodynamics, or the slot, as I call it. Now, the reason I wanted Andrew to come in on this was that that expression is seen from a biological standpoint through this artifact you call the Shard of Turin. And whilst John has beautifully defined this energy connection system, this kind of thing that happened with the shroud shows energy in a different situation and light, so to speak. Literally light, so to speak. And this particular thing then relates to us as thinking into abstractions, as thinking beings, if you see what I mean. Thought is an abstraction. It's not there hard and solid. You can't kind of catch it, touch it, whatever, or bottle it or whatever, and so on. So the point is that this incredible thing of the manifestation of mind, of thought, of the power of that, right, in a way is used in most, you know, New Age kind of paradigms as the energy of thinking and all this kind of thing. Well, you really can't, you shouldn't do that, because you're mixing two things up, I think, and confusing the issue greatly. This expression of mind is a power, if you like. Power is a better way of saying it. The power to change, to stop what is progressing naturally with the Big Bang, you know, breaking up into parts, so to speak. A bang, that's what it does. It goes on and on and on, breaking things up into smaller and smaller parts, if you see what I'm, with time, so to speak. And so Andrew's take on this with the Shard of Turin is very interesting to hear, where the word energy is concerned, and that's really what I think we ought to kind of try and move on to get him to give you a sense of his resource of energy in terms of mind and power.
Okay, yes, Andrew, please.
Sure, certainly. Well, you know, the thing about energy is it's something that is a concept in physics, of a physical effect, of the capacity to do work, which implies the action of force. Now, this is a fascinating subject, the nature of force. Force, basically, in a nutshell, is what makes something happen. You know, and it's always happens in equal balance. So you punch a wall, you might make a small dent in the wall, and you might hurt your fist. Basically, the force exerted on the wall has made an effect on the wall and back upon you. But the thing about force is that it's all determined by other forces. Except there's one exception to that. And that is, if there is such a thing as what we human beings call free choice. Now, if for the sake of argument, we accept that, you know, that 6 billion, 7 billion people aren't wrong in their notion that every day of their lives they're making decisions freely, how does that work when you compare it against the scientific worldview that sees everything that happens as being determined by force? If you can make a choice freely, then by definition, force has not made that choice have to be what it is. And that further implies that that which can exercise free choice has to exist in a state of the absence of force, what the mystics and poets might call peace, for want of a better word, if you like. That force makes things have to happen, and when there's free choice, that implies less force to allow things not to have to happen, but to be chosen to happen or not. And this ties in to the connection that Nigel and I think John were referring to earlier, that anything that lives, anything with sentience, has a connection right back to the beginning of the universe, where there was actually no force at all, at the singularity, at the Big Bang. And interestingly, at the singularity, for those listeners who aren't familiar with this is a scientific notion that the whole universe came from one single point, which is called the Big Bang, and has since separated out. And from that point, there was no space, time, or matter, and it all came out of there. Now, this brings me back to the Turin Shroud. And now I just need to say a little bit about the shroud for those listeners who aren't that familiar with it. It's a 14-foot long piece of cloth which is kept in Turin, Italy, hence the name. And this cloth, some people believe it's only been around for a few hundred years, but there's plenty of evidence out there that it's been around for a lot longer than that. And people might think the carbon dating in the 1980s discredited it. Well, actually, there was some wonderful work that's been done that shows that even the Professor Ramsey from the Oxford Radiocarbon Unit, which is one of the laboratories that dated the shroud, says that more work needs to be done. There's so much evidence that suggests it's older than the carbon dating suggests that, you know, we can't just say ignore everything else and just look at those numbers. Now, to discuss the image a little bit on the shroud, there's two things that form the image. There's red marks that look like bloodstains, which have actually been shown to be bloodstains, to be male human blood. And there's also a very faint image on the cloth, which around the turn of the early 20th century in 1898, when photography was first coming out, a chap called Secunda Pia took a picture of the shroud, and the story goes that he nearly dropped his photographic plate when he saw the negative. When you look at a negative picture of the Turin shroud, what you see is a positive. In other words, the Turin shroud image itself is a photographic negative. It's not painted onto the cloth. There's no pigment to make the image there. It's actually a change in the structure of the cellulose in the linen of the cloth. And the only way that we can account for that scientifically, consistently, is that there was a short, intense burst of radiant energy, this is where the energy comes in, onto the cloth, which actually changed the surface structure. Now, the interesting thing about this image, one of the many interesting things, is that it has something unique called distance-coded information. Now, any photograph, if you try to look for distance-coded information with a special machine called an image intensifier that can find that kind of thing, you just see it's not there, basically. If you put it through there to try and get the three-dimensional information out of it, you just see a random set of peaks and troughs. But if you do that to the shroud, it comes out in a perfect three-dimensional relief to actually see the shape of the man that the cloth wrapped. What that implies to optical scientists is that the light that formed this photographic negative was not reflected off the body of the man. It actually shone from the body of the man. Now, this implies that actually a human body can shine. It had to have been brighter than the sun for less than a billionth of a second. And the question is, how did that happen? And interesting thing to me and to many other people is, who was this person who shone brighter than the sun? Well, this is where the forensic experts come in. Now, the image on the cloth has been studied as people might study a crime scene, if you like, looking at it anatomically and pathologically and so on. And it's been found that it's an image of a man who had been cruelly tortured. He'd been whipped, and his skin had been broken over 100 times. If you look at the shape of the imprints of the marks where his skin was broken, it fits exactly with what archaeologists know as the Roman flagrum, which the Romans used to use as an instrument of torture 2,000 years ago. He was crucified through the wrists. Now, all medieval artists used to depict crucifixion as having been through the hands, but anatomically we know that that's not possible, wouldn't have taken the weight of the man. And crucifixion through the wrist would have had an effect on something called the median nerve, which would make the thumb curl in behind the palm. And in fact, that's what you see on the cloth. The thumb isn't visible, but it's behind the hand. I could actually go on for many hours just about the confirmations from forensics that the anatomy, pathology, and so on demonstrates that this is a genuine thing. But another fascinating thing is that there are blood marks on the scalp, on the head of this man, that imply that a set of sharp objects, like a cap of thorns, was placed on his head, and he was also stabbed through the side. Now, all of these things are unique to the story of a particular individual who would have been known in his time as Yeshua ben Yosef, who we now know in the English-speaking world as Jesus. Now, the question that then occurs to anyone is it just coincidence that this unique event, which is unique as far as we know in the history of mankind, that a dead human body shone brighter than the sun, is actually connected directly to the historical person of someone who has been, through what they taught and how they lived, has had one of the greatest impacts on human history of anybody? And then the next question is, could there be a connection? Is this just not coincidence? Is this telling us something about the connection between mind and matter, that something about who he was, how he, in terms of how he lived his life, was actually responsible for this phenomenon? Now, if you want to take a common denominator, if you like, of what Jesus stood for and how he lived, I think you could say that he summed it up when he pointed people to the saying, love your neighbor as yourself. Now, that's a fascinating thing to say, because it implies that actually your neighbor is yourself, that actually fundamentally we're all one. And this goes back to what John was alluding to earlier about Schrödinger, one of the founders of quantum theory, who actually made the point that if you look at consciousness, then it's actually a singular, universal thing. It's the same basic consciousness, whoever it's in. All that's different is our individual experience in the choices that we make. And the other fascinating thing that Schrödinger said about consciousness is that consciousness doesn't happen in time. Consciousness makes time. That we have this concept of there being a now only because there's consciousness. And the thing that he derived from that is that if time is a product of consciousness, then consciousness can't be made in time and can't end in time. It must, in other words, be eternal. And if it's eternal, then it's there right back, including the beginning of the universe, in that singularity. If we were there in that singularity, we must have all been one at that stage, which then implies that we've now become separate. And as Nigel was alluding to about the second law of thermodynamics, there's this momentum, this relentless momentum in this physical universe that breaks everything apart, that you only go from order into chaos and not the other way around in this physical universe. And perhaps that momentum was initially started off by a choice of sentient being, consciousness, if you like, to experience separation, to separate. And that after all, what is space but the separation of points? What is time but separate moments? And it's all of the physical universe is an expression of separation. And if you look at that expressed in human terms, in psychological terms, you can see that as time goes on, it would tend to imply that the momentums that separate in thought, if you like, selfishness, materialism, prejudice, racism, all of these kind of isms, if you like, that divide man from his neighbor, are actually a product of this breaking up momentum that takes us out of, that threatens our very existence, if you like. And perhaps what great teachers like Jesus were alluding to is that there's an antidote to that. That if you unite instead of dividing, if you care instead of separating and respect that, you know, your neighbor is yourself and so on, then maybe you can actually undo this separating momentum and undo the force that divides and that freezes matter, and therefore releases the light, that such as happened on the shroud. We'll come back to this later, but I think Nigel would like to come in now.
Yeah. Oh, actually, gentlemen, we are at the top of the hour. Boy, that went fast. Like I said, there's no way we can do all this in 2 hours. I'm enjoying myself just sitting back and listening. You are taking the subject, all three of you, exactly where I want it to go. Anyways, everybody, you're listening to Voice of the People on the Paranormal Radio Network. Exciting interview. We'll be right back.
Well, Welcome back to The Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Well, thank you.
That's a story in itself. What is the etiology of the naming of you as November? That would be really nice to know.
Well, I used to like to tell people because my mother was from the 60s era, but that's not really it. Her name was Mary. And when she went to school and they called on Mary, half the class raised their hand. So she wanted her daughters to go to school and have the teacher call on them, and they were the only ones who rose their hand. That's it.
Oh wow. That's wonderful. I love it. Absolutely love it.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. How lovely.
Oh, okay. My producer just sent me a message that we're actually back on the air, so now everybody who listens to Voice of the People knows how I got my name. Oh, he forgot to send me the music. Okay, thanks, Joe. Everybody, you're listening to Voice of the People on the Paranormal Radio Network. My guests this evening are Nigel Koerner. Radio's, spontaneous. It's nice to have fun and not get your cues. And anyways, gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Hi there. This is Nigel speaking here.
Nigel, I'm going to let you direct. Where do you want to go next?
Well, I was just going to say that before we had the break, Dr. Silverman was making the point about individualizations in terms of this person who appears on this piece of cloth they call the Shroud of Turin. And he very eloquently, I thought, showed us that what this person was trying to do by leaving this relic or artifact for the world 2,000 years ago was do something really very special that actually points to Dr. Silverman's about things. The less you're able to arbitrate in terms of tribalism and all the things that divide us, that there is something wondrous about knowledge. That's the real lesson that I learned, that as we went into all this research, investigating this incredible thing, phenomenon of the UFO appearances around the world and so on, we began to see that this thing connected up in every particular way to our aegis as humanity in general, and that the things we do now to bring about such terrible testimony of our natures, violence, dividing mankind into tribes, screaming at each other over tiny points on a tiny planet in a universe teeming with, I believe, life and all kinds of different presentations of physical force and matter and so on. And here we are on this tiny planet, killing and doing the most awful things to each other. Indeed, doing it to the man or the being that left us this lesson 2,000 years ago with his death, mangling him for caring and loving and so forth, and that this incredible thing was in itself pointing to our present day's situation where it's saying and screaming at us all, forget the nonsense, because humanity is a powerful thing, bigger than the universe, if you can simply think and know. And that's the most important thing of all, because there is something beyond this frame of physical results in a physical atomic context, and something goes on past that and continues and so forth. And all of this comes from just looking at the UFO phenomenon that my son asked me with a simple question, Dad, are UFOs real? Three decades ago. And so that really is the great lesson of all of this. And if I may say so, I think Andrew wants to say a little bit more about this wonderful, remarkable phenomenon he was talking about, and that's the Shroud of Turin.
Yes.
Well, Andrew, I'm going to have you talk about it, but I also have a question. What is the one single test that you would love to see done on the Shroud of Turin that has not been done?
Well, you see, I'd like to see carbon dating done on a piece of the actual Turin Shroud itself rather than a patch that was sewn in later.
Oh, okay. That would be nice.
This is the problem, yeah, that so far what we've got is a date according to research by a great chemist from Los Alamos Laboratory, Raymond Rogers had a paper, a peer-reviewed paper published in a journal showing that the part of the cloth that was dated was not representative of the rest of the shroud. So the answer to that is, I'd like to see it done properly. That would be nice.
But, okay.
If I could
go
come
ahead.
In again about carrying on from what Nigel was saying. You see, this is an interesting issue, this thing about religion, because if you actually look at what Jesus taught and how he lived, it's really not about religion, you know. When he was asked, what his purpose was, what he was trying to do, he didn't say anything about religion. He said, I was born for one reason and one reason alone, to bear witness to the truth. Now, if you find something that makes sense and is true, it can be shown to be true, that can't be contradicted rationally, you don't need belief anymore as such. And it could actually be argued that if people define God as being all-knowing, that means God doesn't believe anything. That means God isn't religious. So if the religions are trying to become more what's rational, and that's the thing about what he taught, that it does make such immense sense, and you can tie that into to this fundamental principle that Nigel defines in terms of union and separation. I remember he has this analogy with a piece of paper that when you tear it and put it apart, it's less useful than when it's actually together. That you can see this momentum of separation, which breaks everything apart in the entropic drift of the physical universe, only leads to the end of existence. Whereas if you unite, bring together through caring and so on, then your scope for existence is greater. Now, the thing about this image on the shroud, and the thing about this individual, Yeshua or Jesus, whatever we call him, is that though people have placed him on a pedestal as an icon, his message was always saying about humanity in general. He referred to himself as the Son of Man, and he said, all these things I do, you can do also. So, and even greater than these can you do. So that's the point, is that the image on the shroud shows not just what one person did at one time and that therefore should be put on a pedestal and praised and worshipped. I really don't think he wanted that. I think he wanted us to see what we are all capable of. Now, one particular point in the story of Jesus that bears saying, since we're talking about the subject of artificiality and so on and these sort of technology and roboids and so on, is the story of what's known in the New Testament as the temptation. Now, according to the story, Jesus was a globe of the earth, and you find if you point it in a certain direction, pretty much all of the landmass is all visible as long as you're out in space. You have to be out in space to look at it, to see it all. So that actually implies that he wasn't on the top of a tower. He was actually in space, that he was actually taken into space by this creature that was referred to as the devil, that he called Satan, which interestingly is a mythological character who is supposed to have been something that fell out of the sky. So you can see it's all piecing together now. And it was seen as, in some sense, an opposite, an adversary. The literal translation from the Hebrew of Satan is adversary of God. Okay, so how can you be an opposite of God? If we take it that the common assumption at the time is that to be alive, to be a living entity, you have to contain, you have to be made in the image of God, you have to contain something of you which is godlike or is derived of God, then that makes you in some way similar, have that content of God in you, however evil you might be. But if something is artificial, it's not alive, it has no mind, it has no sentience, it's just a roboid, then that's as far removed from God as you could get. So it would make sense that if there were such a thing notionally as a devil, if you like, it wouldn't even have sentience. It would have no conscience because it had no mind. It would just be a programmed machine, just as Nigel alludes to with the idea of the greys being.
Let's go back to the greys just for a moment, Nigel. Do you believe that they are all more or less an artificial intelligence, or do you believe that there are grays within grays? I did a study myself. What I got out of it was we weren't necessarily talking about a one-size-fits-all type thing here, that there were different things going on, like what we might find in our own civilization with different races of people, different cultures, that type of thing. What's your opinion of it from your studies?
My take is quite simply this, November, and that is that when you've got something like a strange phenomenon occurring, you really have to define very sharply what you actually mean about the phenomenon itself. Now, when I talk about the greys, I am talking about the majority of interactions imply a grey robe, grey creature, small creature that appears and abducts people and does unspeakable experiments on them and so on. Well, this prevails is the prevailing consensus of this phenomenon of UFOs is associated predominantly with this type of expression. I am not saying that there are no natural beings that come in with the universe out there, the same as we have, if you like, down the line, so to speak, that have souls. Of course there are. And my objection to all of this is that we have to look at two things. The power of what is natural and comes through from that original point with the Big Bang, and that which is created within the universe since then, artificially, and given the kind of expression that is, if you like, intelligent through artificial dispositions, given that in those terms, programmed into it as a kind of synthetic modulus modality, if you see what I mean. And I'm saying that what we really need to do is to watch that interface extremely carefully, because if we don't do that, these things that are driven by a program we call the greys, because they are synthetic roboidal machines, they are machines, not much different, if you like, in their construct, to your vacuum cleaner or whatever it is, in terms of existential validity, so to speak, that those things, if you give them a machine artificial intelligence, we have a very big problem, and we don't know it to be that, we have a very big problem. That is the most important distinction to make. Now, I know people say there may be other types of races coming here and all kinds of different experiences are explained in terms of those. Whatever that might be, you've got to consider one very important thing, and that is if they are superior to us, then they've had to deal with the second law of thermodynamics the same as we have. And that thing is in the business, this second law, is in the business of rotting everything, of destroying everything, including the universe. So wherever they might be in the universe, however they might be presented in natural terms, if they come in with the universe like us, they too will be susceptible to the second law of thermodynamics, wherever that might be, because it's a universal law. And so they too will be rotting. Now the problem with that is that as you rot, if you don't are not aware that there's something more than a physical universe, more than atoms, more than the thing that began with the Big Bang, that there must have been something beyond the Big Bang that we all came from and everything in the Big Bang came from, if we're not aware of that and we don't know that distinction that there must be something beyond and that there may well be a beyond too in our atomic nest, if you see what I'm trying to say, if we're not aware of that and we just think the only scope of our being is in here, in-house, in the universe, so to speak, we are in big, big trouble, because we'll fall into the trap of making synthetic stuff, putting programs into it, and I tell you what, that's the biggest danger of all. That is the thing that is happening now. That we are slowly moving on to what I believe is in SIM card man. I said that previously, where a tiny little piece smaller than the eye can see may be injected into your body through a needle. And that thing can quite easily control your thinking, your ability to know, and all the various things that take away the property of our free will to do and understand the way our individuality dictates it should be done. If that is taken away, then we are lost. We have lost an eternal scale of possible existence, if you see what I'm trying to say. And that principle is what I'm defending now. And so my little boy, who was 12 years old at the time when he asked me the question, Dad, are UFOs real, has really pointed to me something that I don't think I would otherwise have found. I would have drifted into the, you know, the day's own troubles like everyone else does and so forth, and carried on in a way not really is something that's the greatest lesson in my life. Let the little child lead you. Now, you know, I was talking about New Age people and so on. By and large, I found them to be really sweet, nice individuals. I have a little bit of an axe to grind with them in that they tend to obfuscate and make nice all the edges and so forth. They're not definite enough. They tend to be a little bit obscure. However, they are showing us the way in saying, be pleasant. Be nice to each other. I remember the end of the 60s, with the flower people and all that kind of business and so forth. So there's an awful lot to be said for hippies, if you like. And you're to be congratulated if you describe yourself as a hippie, let me say so. But, you know, the description is really irrelevant. Whatever the description is, it doesn't change what the constituents of the existentiality of an individual might be. And so therefore, pointing to your question again, yes, there'll be thousands of different varieties of natural existence with soul, with lines tracking back to the beginning of the universe. What I'm fighting is the artificial stuff we create in between after that has happened, and we've got to take a very, very strong look at how and why we give these things powers, and most of all, what powers are given to this kind of phenomenon.
You know what, Nigel, I agree. And you know, part of the beauty of being human is the individuality, is the, you know, you talk about New Age or hippies or anything like that. They're kind of fun, maybe bad things. Professor Biggerstaff, I have a question for you. Looking at artificial intelligence, I actually know somebody of science who freaks intelligence. How far do you think we are from that?
Well, in fact, we're getting closer and closer. And what we're finding in science now is that, you know, this is exponential. It's actually sort of increasing with time, you know. And in fact, Ray Kurzweil has just actually published an article on this, and essentially he thinks that this exponential growth will lead us by 2050 to, you know, to actually a full integration of our brains with technology. And I think, you know, the big problem about all of this is that, you know, the difference between the natural and the artificial, what is natural in a way, you know, it's a dual-sided thing. Our bodies, we have our bodies, but we also have our souls, and the bodies are really an expression of what that soul is doing. If you start putting stuff in there, which is artificial, then it, to some extent, it's not under the control of the consciousness anymore, and therefore it can be controlled by other factors. And this is one reason, you know, that we're postulating that these mitochondria, these little factories with their own DNA, were put into cells, for instance. And this is a sort of between these two different things. And really, when it goes sort of fully electronic, and we already know how to put little chips on our brains, you know. And in fact, this is all done really with the apparently very good reason of actually helping people that have deficiencies in some of the senses. For instance, you know, to try and help people to see and to make, you know, putting things on their brain so that they can see again. But the problem is that although there's always a good side to something, you know, like discovering atomic energy, which was a wonderful boon effectively for energy, you can make atomic bombs with it. In the same sort of way, I think there's a sort of downside to the electronics, because effectively it gives artificiality a handle on controlling you, and that takes away your free will. I mean, you are no longer able to control that. And therefore, you are not able to continue your natural cycle or to go back to your origin, because you've now got a complexity within you which you can't actually resolve. And I think that's a big problem with all of this.
Okay, I have a question from the virtual auditorium, and it's actually a really good one. And either one of you gentlemen that would like to jump in and answer, go for it. But Villa's asking, souls may be emergent properties of our bodies. So might not souls also emerge from what starts off as an artificial life form?
Well, you see, the thing is, November, this idea that the soul being an emergent property of the body, it doesn't quite fit rationally, it seems to me, because you see, if you look at, for example, at quantum theory that I think John and Nigel were alluding to earlier, that actually what we found in is that consciousness is actually vital in terms of actually making the reality real, making matter real. So in other words, the atom is there because of consciousness. So in that sense, consciousness can't be synthesized from an arrangement of atoms. You can't get atoms into a certain position and make it there. It's the other way around. Consciousness is the prime mover in this, and the atoms are more likely to be a result of consciousness than consciousness is to be a result of the atoms. And there's been some good research on this done by a scientist over here in England, actually, called Rupert Sheldrake, who's done studies on what he terms a morphogenetic field, which shows that actually there is something of us that makes that our sort of conscious sentient side, which you cannot actually replicate or produce by arrangements of atoms, but it actually helps to arrange the atoms, if you like, that the actual formatting and shaping of the brain is a result of consciousness rather than consciousness just being made by the brain. Before I finish, I just would like to mention some research also that's been done on near-death experiences. Now, people may be familiar with the idea that people see when they almost die, they see, as a doctor, I've had several patients who have told me after being resuscitated about near-death experiences that they have had. Now, they don't just see tunnels of light and their loved ones and so on. What they often see is they have a remote viewing experience where they see, while their brain waves are flat, they experience things that are happening and can see it from a vantage point above the ceiling and see things that are happening in remote places, that they, even blind people have had this experience and seen these things that they couldn't have known about. And neuropsychiatrists studying this have come to the conclusion that actually we have to rethink our notion of what the mind is, that it's not an emergent property of the brain, that when the brain is completely not functioning at all, the mind is still there. And I think Nigel would like to come in.
Yeah. And that's the crucial thing, November, in answering that question, which is a very good one. Can you not give something synthetic a soul? The point is, you cannot. You have to come in from something that preempts our existence from the point of the Big Bang. And that is what gives everything to us. Whatever that was that existed previous to the Big Bang actually drives the properties of all of us in the natural cadence of things. If you artificially, after that has occurred, put something together, it doesn't get that property. So you can't, in fact, go back in time and start before the Big Bang, so to speak. And that's why synthetic artificiality cannot really have a soul. Its soul, if you like, begins when it is created. When you stick those atoms together, and as Andrew so eloquently put it, it is impossible to get configurations of force points in space we call atoms, if you like, together in such a way that it suddenly gets this property of life. They've tried to do this all along in science since we first discovered, you know, the so-called primeval soup and all that business that science talks about. I think it's total poppycock, because you will never get livingness in the sense we understand natural livingness to be. We'll never get that into an artificially modulated, created mechanism as such. And so the answer to that, in my terms, of all the research that I've looked at and seen and studied carefully, is that you cannot do that with an artificial modality like a robot or a robot. You cannot give it a soul. In terms of that precept of a soul, in a line of information, It would have one, but it would start, in a sense, from the point that those assemblies were put together. Yet you wouldn't give it that ability to relate back to a point where everything is together and get a consensus of all-knowingness, so to speak, if you see what I mean. You can't go back and add up all the knowledge, if you see what I'm trying to say. Only whatever is put in at the moment, any particular artificial modality is created, would be the sum total of the way that modality functions from then on, so to speak. So, no, that is a non-starter, if you see what I'm trying to say. And that's what I'm pointing at, really, in the book, in the song, in both the Song of the Greys, and that's the first book and the second one, the one you referred to. And that book is really there to say to human beings, be very careful now that we are beginning to do this business of putting in microchips and all the rest of it into our being, because I'll tell you what, one fine day, man shall walk his machine. I am absolutely certain of that if we are not very, very careful, because it'll creep in, November. It'll come in obsequiously. It'll come in hidden kinds of ways and so on. And before we know where we are, there will be individuals who will exploit that, power cartels and so forth, who might take this on and take away something, not knowing that there might be a property beyond atoms that all living natural beings are inheritors of. Not knowing that fact, they may do this, and then we have lost the greatest of all expressions of our being, and that is our eternal scope. So that's something I think everybody should shout from the rooftops, if you like, before you allow power groups to be able to take over and control the property of our individual beings, so to speak.
Okay, I have a couple of questions, and I see the questions, guys. There's quite a few there, but I also have one too. So when the soul comes into existence, a child is born, is this something that is new, emergent, and individual and fresh with each child born, or are they recycled?
Yeah, well, it's a lovely term, isn't it? When you actually ascribe that to a human being. Well, recycled is more what it might be, I think. I think that what happens is we continue our lines always. And we have, and I am absolutely convinced now, even though I've had a Christian background by implication, I tell you, not by activity, but by implication. I'm not an organized religion man at all, particularly in the Catholic sense. I'll shout from the rooftops that I reject these creatures in Rome who go around in Pope Mobiles and Cardinal Cadillacs, dressed in golden uniforms and all the rest of it, while the rest of the world is suffering and starving. I would much rather, here's a bit of propaganda, if you like, go out there and make sure all of that's corrected before you start pitching into all this nonsense, if you see what I'm trying to say. My point is quite simply this. You really, in a sense, have to take care of that, the value of our existence. And I think the value of our existence is that we live, we die, and we come back again and re-emerge into a situation where we learn some more. Is much more likely to be true. In fact, everyone believed in reincarnation once upon a time. And I have to say, to my shame and my chagrin, I had no idea of it till I actually started looking at this phenomenon of the UFO business. And through that, I began to see that there has to be a line of continuity for each and every one of us. So death is not the end. It truly, for me, I believe this absolutely, and I think, I hope I've done this as cogently as it's possible to do in the book, that there is this line of continuity that we all inherit, and it's not the end. We begin there, and maybe a new lap starts and so forth. But the point is this, you have to have the wombs to come back into. And what if those wombs are made artificial? What if there is an interruption put there through the insertion of electronic devices and so on, where we mechanize the naturalness of humanity? And that's the terrifying thought to me. And that's why I caution against it, you see.
Okay, gentlemen, can we be sure that we are not an artificial creation ourselves? Silence.
I'm sorry. Well, I didn't, I, 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 I beg your pardon. I did not get the question. Sorry.
The question is, can we be sure that we are not artificial life forms ourselves?
Oh, very simple. I'll tell you what. Let's get, I mean, I've been spewing out this stuff too much now. Let's give Andrew and John a take on this.
Well, it wasn't my question, by the way.
Sure. I mean, the thing is, the clue to it, I think, is in the word we. Because if there is someone to use the first person or the first person plural like that to say I or we, that implies sentience, you see. And the whole point that we were alluding to earlier is that you, consciousness, sentience, cannot be made artificially. So if there is an I to ask the question or a we to ask the question, then it's not artificial. You see, that's the thing. Your computer is just like a glorified abacus, if you like. It's, although it may have more complex inputs and outputs, it's a mechanical device. It never has, there's no ghost in the machine, if you like. There's nothing behind the eyes of a robot that can look out and experience feelings and emotions and or consciousness or any kind of sensory perceptions even that can be registered as an experience. There's only inputs and outputs and nothing in between. So could I be artificial? If there is a you to ask the question, then you're not artificial.
Okay.
Yeah. The wonderful thing about this is that when you look at things, hitch them up to reason, to 1 + 1 = 1 + 1, and not 2, by the way. Perhaps mathematicians will agree with me there. When everything has its exact equivalence, so to speak, you know, in this, in the whole makeup and expression of being, of the existential tray, if you like, that when that is followed, then we can actually see for ourselves all the mythology and the rubbish that individual people, because of comfort points or whatever their own particular agenda is, might be, that we do not get misled. So reason is very, very good indeed. But then again, science, being empiricist, is limited. It can only make no comment and cannot have a comment, it seems, to make on what put the thing there in the first place. And how did that happen, so to speak? And that's the big problem, is if we take just science alone, we're in trouble there too. And so you see, in November, we need a balance of reason to be brought in. Reason balances, and it's the balance of reason that I think gives us this power to be able to, if you like, speak about this phenomenon we call the truth, to affirm the truth. And really, you know, you cannot put tribes to anything, basically. It's all open out there. And out there is where it is open, so to speak. I'm sorry, I hope I don't sound too much like some obscure guru or whatever it is.
I really don't
mean to be, you know.
No, you
actually,
don't.
If I might come in here, one of the things I found in science is that, you know, a lot of our research is that Nigel, Andrew, and I have been doing, in fact, are already published. You know, a lot of basic ideas that we're generating our concepts from, a lot of them are published in various areas of science. The problem with science over the last 50 to 100 years is that you get an increase in specialization. And I think that a lot of scientists really just never go and look out there to actually give themselves a wider view. And so the views in science become more specialized and more narrow. And, you know, I mean, I try to drive my science really by crossing subject boundaries. I'm working with physics and biochemistry and cell biology, etc. And in fact, you know, once you bring into it the philosophy and logic that Andrew and Nigel have been speaking about, I think one gets a much clearer story. And one can ask, you know, that are in science. I think there is a change happening in science at the moment. There seem to be a growing number of scientists who are really beginning to say, hey, this concept of consciousness itself is a real problem. It's not something, you know, I mean, so the sort of axiom in evolutionary theory is it spontaneously occurred. Well, in fact, that doesn't seem, there's no real rationale behind saying that, apart from that they said, well, it's there, so it must have come about. But there's no real rational logic behind that. And therefore, I think that, you know, if one takes a wider view of this whole thing, as is beginning to happen, I think that we can design a science. Really, science has been designed so far to measure things, atoms and forces and things between them. But now we're starting to get an inkling that there's this other side to the universe where consciousness lives, if you like, as a continuum. And we're going to have to really start to change and try and understand the rationales by which we can actually implicate these functions in our mechanism of life.
The thing about scientists is that they are really relentless drones driven by very strict margins, if you like. Unfortunately, these days, in modern terms, science tends to be more the pursuit of grants than the pursuit of knowledge. And you know that is really a powerful thing. And that's a very, very dangerous thing to happen, because you will not get knowledge. You will get only what you want to see. And I think the real problem is that so many people have distorted religious thinking, and they've made God into this anthropomorphic lord of the manor, super lord of the manor, super mummy and daddy kind of ethos. And that's been kind of shown to be totally defunct, that science doesn't want to go there anymore. And they do all kinds of things to kind of avoid that. And, of course, when they do that, they throw the baby out with the bathwater. And that's also a big problem, if you see what I'm trying to say. So as I say, November, it's all a question of well-thought-out balance. How do we really want to see the best that there can be in terms of knowing and understanding things? And that, I think, is what I'm, in a sense, underlining in what I've discovered about these lights moving, as I say. I started off with the phenomenon of all those various Buck Rogers business. Put me off, you know, the UFO phenomenon and all that. And I was tempted to say to my son, don't go there, it's Mickey Mouse stuff, you know, it's all nonsense. Yet as I looked at it and I went through it seriously, so that he wouldn't come back at me later on, he's a pretty well-hitched up fellow up top, and I wasn't going to be put down by him, father to son, so to speak. When I looked at it, of course, his simple little question from a 12-year-old boy, in fact, turned me over. And I think that was the greatest thing that has ever happened to me. And I hope that as a dad, that I want all the dads and the mums in the world to be able to give that legacy to their children. Reasoned, well, cogent, reasoned thinkability and freedom to think and change your mind. The crucial thing is the freedom to change your mind. And if we can do that, I think we have hope for our human species.
You know what? I want to see children challenged. You know what? The best thing, I work in education. The best thing that can ever happen to me is when a young person asks a question. That means they're thinking. You know what?
It's a beautiful thing.
It is. It is a beautiful thing. Yeah. It's just, it is amazing. We have 6 minutes left in the program, gentlemen. I didn't even get to ask, what's the harvesting of the souls? And Nigel, I want you to be able to tell the listening audience where they can get a copy of Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of the Souls, and if any of you have websites you'd like to encourage people to visit.
Yeah, well, I don't seem to be, I don't want to be insincere about this. I really, that's not my department. I just write the stuff when I see it, and it hangs together, so to speak. There are other people to do this for me. I often forget the title of my book, but I now remember it because somebody's put a note in front of me saying saying Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls,
and you
can actually get it on Amazon, and it's and if you go to the website nigelkerner.com, I think most of your questions may be answered there. So let's keep it brief. I'm not in this business to advertise the book, so to speak. I'm in the business to make people understand so much that they all will write books.
There you go. How about you, Andrew? Do you have a website where you post information about the Shroud of Turin?
Not as yet, but there are some good websites out there. But my presentation that I gave in Frascati is you can find it on the web. If you do a search for IWSAI, I think it's the name of was the conference I went to. And you'll see the proceedings there, and my one is amongst them. I mean, there are plenty of other good things that were written in the proceedings as well by my colleagues there also.
Okay, how about you, John? Any place where somebody can go and look at some of your work?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my work is to do with immunology and cancer and stuff like that. But obviously peripherally that sort of relates to you know, my interest in all of these other things too. I'm at the University of Tennessee, and anybody could look me up there on the website's list there. I have a website which needs serious updating. But if people want to see what I do, or if they want to communicate with me, they can get me through there.
Okay.
I think that, yeah, if I may say so, both Andrew and John need serious updating from time to time, and I promise you I try my best to do that. But Andrew's just got married, so he's in a kind of special situation of being up there, so to speak, at the moment. Mm-hmm. John and I have done this business a long time, and so we're a little bit more settled in it. So we're in the business now of helping Andrew along the way, so to speak, if you see what I mean, November.
I do. Well, wait, Andrew, till you've been married for, let's see, 27 years. Yeah. You'll just be an old hat like the rest of them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it's been wonderful talking to you, I must say. Anyway, I mean, I just don't know. I mean, it's very simple, you know. In the end, it comes down to this business you were talking about, the Greys and the voice of the people and so forth. You know, the only thing in the world that might actually bring all these cautions to bear on behalf of our human family is things like the voice of the people and so forth out there going and asking people to look for themselves, to search, not to take, you know, what someone else says to you, not to be secondhand, that there is a great and fantastic power in every single in the research mechanisms that we used and what they revealed, and where when we connected up the dots, that's what became so apparent. So rather like this wonderful business of the Turin Shroud, it's really something that was left, if you like, to us to see. It's an amazing thing how this wondrous being left this artifact 2,000 years ago, almost as though he knew, and of course he did, I'm sure he did, he knew that we were going to come up to this confluence of decisions that we would have to make in the future. Maybe 2012 is what this is all about, that in fact we have to decide, are we going to be a kept type of entity as human beings, or are we going to use a power we all have to be able to think and resolve within our own special terms, our own individualities, and bring to bear the lessons these people tried to teach us by their own life examples, so to speak, and so on. So if we live for a state of being beyond death and not a state of being in life, I think we might find the antidote.
Michael, I have to stop you. We are at the end of the program, but as you were talking about the voice of the people, aren't the voices of the people rising across the globe and some of the other places? It is phenomenal to be able to witness something like that. Anyway, gentlemen, I have enjoyed you all immensely. Everybody, you've been listening to Voice of the People Radio on the Paranormal Radio Network, and next week, I didn't write down who my guest is, so guess what? You'll get to check out my website at www.voiceofthepeopleradio.com to find out who. Until then, have a great week ahead. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Voice of the People with host November Hansen on the Paranormal Radio Network.